so tall, you understand, says the way you didn't see nothing else but the sky. For 8 years I lived like that. But I never lost focus on what my mission was.
Ronnie Long, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ronnie Long spent 44 years in a North Carolina prison for a crime he did not commit, released in August after a federal appeals court vacated his conviction, and the state finally dropped the case. He voted for the first time this year. His website is freeronnielong.org. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tedesena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, and Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
La ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the last 14 years, Give Guide has raised over $28 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Support KBOO and learn more about Give Guide by going to kboo.fm/give. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, early data on a COVID-19 vaccine by Moderna shows it is 94% effective. New coronavirus restrictions go into place on Wednesday in Oregon as the pandemic surges across the country, and data from the Portland Police Bureau shows police used excessive force during the 2020 racial justice demonstrations. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 16th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. According to early data released by the Massachusetts biotechnology company Moderna, their COVID-19 vaccine is 94.5% effective. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, said, quote, "These are obviously very exciting results. It's just as good as it gets. 94% is truly outstanding," end quote. Fauci added that vaccinations could begin in the second half of December for high-risk groups. It would then be available for the rest of the population in the spring. Those who are considered high risk include healthcare workers, senior citizens, and people with underlying medical conditions. The news of Moderna's vaccine comes about a week after Pfizer announced that early data shows its vaccine is more than 90% effective against COVID-19. Moderna says it plans to apply to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for emergency authorization of its vaccine soon after it accumulates more safety data later this month. Both Pfizer and Moderna's vaccines use the same technique to activate the body's immune system. Both vaccines require two doses that are given several weeks apart. One advantage to Moderna's vaccine is that it can be kept at minus 4 degrees Fahrenheit, while Pfizer's vaccine must be kept at negative 103 degrees Fahrenheit. No other vaccine in the U.S. needs to be kept that cold, and many doctors' offices and pharmacies do not have freezers that reach such a low temperature. In comparison, Moderna's vaccine needs to be kept at temperatures similar to the chickenpox vaccine. Another advantage is that Moderna's vaccine can be kept for 30 days in a refrigerator, while Pfizer's vaccine only lasts 5 days in storage. Dr. Fauci said he expects the first COVID-19 vaccinations to begin, quote, towards the latter part of December rather than in the early part of December. He added, quote, I think that everybody will start to get vaccinated toward the end of April, and that will go into May, June, July. It will take a couple of months to do, end quote. The Oregon Health Authority reported 781 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the state's total number of confirmed and presumptive cases up to 57,646. Oregon health officials also reported 4 more deaths, raising the state's death toll to 765. The state's surge of COVID-19 cases continues as over the past 12 days, Oregon has had its highest daily case counts yet, with an average of 896 cases per day. Multnomah County reported the highest number of new cases with 231, followed by Washington County with 118 and Clackamas and Marion counties with 71 each. Hospitals across Oregon say their intensive care units are at or nearing capacity. On Friday, officials said there are only 15 ICU beds available in the Portland metro region. They said that is the lowest they've seen since the pandemic began. OHSU said all 4 of their ICUs are operating at 90% capacity right now. The hospital added that current demand for staff is greater than the supply. Governor Kate Brown's statewide freeze goes into effect on Wednesday, imposing various restrictions on businesses and gatherings. The restrictions include prohibiting indoor and outdoor dining, closing indoor recreational facilities, limiting grocery store and retail capacity to 75%, and closing indoor and outdoor event venues. The freeze will last through Wednesday, December 2nd for most counties, but Brown noted that some are likely to stay in the freeze for longer. Multnomah County will be under the restrictions for at least 4 weeks. The governor also asked Oregonians to limit social gatherings to no more than 6 people from 2 households or less. The freeze does not change safety protocols already in place for hair salons and barbershops, K-12 schools, Division I and professional athletics, as well as higher education. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler said of the freeze, quote, many Portlanders have made major sacrifices during this pandemic. This freeze, while challenging, will help ensure fewer sacrifices down the road and a strong recovery. And most importantly, this freeze will save lives. On Sunday, Washington Governor Jay Inslee also announced new restrictions for the state, including closing indoor dining, limiting outdoor dining to 5 people per table, capping in-store retail capacity at 25%, and prohibiting indoor social gatherings with people outside a household. The statewide restrictions for Washington also close gyms and movie theaters and limit religious services to 25% capacity or 200 people, whichever is fewer. The rules for Washington State go into effect tonight at midnight and will remain in effect until December 14th, while the restrictions on restaurants take effect Tuesday night at midnight. Inslee also announced another $50 million in federal aid for impacted businesses and workers in the state of Washington. Nationally, COVID-19 cases have reached 11 million in a new major case spike. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 150,000 cases per day. That's an increase of 81% from the average 2 weeks earlier. More than 246,000 people have died across the country. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 54.8 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.3 million people have died across the world. A class action lawsuit claims Amazon, quote, knowingly subjected its majority-minority line workers to unsafe working conditions as compared with white managers. Diane Bernard has more on the story with the Public News Service.
A former Amazon employee is suing the e-commerce giant for failing to provide safe working conditions for Black and Brown employees in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. Christian Smalls worked in a warehouse in New York and claims Amazon provided white managers with protective equipment and enforced social distancing back in March. But after Smalls requested similar treatment for his Black and Hispanic team and led a protest, the company failed to do so. His attorney, C.K. Hoffler, alleges that at the time, Amazon also didn't provide proper protections for workers in many other regions across the country, which led Smalls to speak out.
As a result of Chris Smalls speaking up, engaging in really protected activity, he was unceremoniously terminated. That's what this is about. And so people outside of New York absolutely should pay attention to this. In fact, Amazon employees internationally have stood in solidarity with Chris Smalls.
Amazon officials deny any racial discrimination in its COVID response. It also defended the firing of Chris Smalls, saying he led his protest in March while he was supposed to be quarantined, and that endangered the health of workers. The class action lawsuit looks to represent all Black and Hispanic employees who were impacted by Amazon's actions in March. Hoffler says the company could easily afford to compensate Smalls and others. She says folks are relying on Amazon even more during the pandemic, and the company has made record-breaking profits since shutdowns began.
We want the workplace to be better. Amazon should be held accountable, like others, for their misdeeds, for putting profits before people, for endangering the lives of people. Unfortunately, people have died at that facility. So this is real.
For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
A new use of force audit by the Portland Police Bureau reveals police used violence against protesters at least 2,378 times in the first 32 days of 2020's racial justice demonstrations. This number is three times higher than all instances of crowd control violence over the past 4 years. The report, released Wednesday by PPB's audit team, uses data provided by officers self-reporting their own use of force during this period. Types of force used are broken down by category, such as baton strikes, chemical agents, and launched impact weapons. The report is long overdue. It comes a month after a review by the court-mandated compliance officer and community liaison found Portland out of compliance with a 2014 settlement agreement requiring quarterly audits of use of force and training. The settlement agreement came after federal courts found PPB employed a pattern of excessive force against the mentally ill. Initial audits released last quarter did not include crowd control use of force and revealed nearly 500 officers lacked the use of force training required for state certification. Now, over a month later, the newly released audit shows police reported using CS gas a minimum of 203 times over the first 32 days of protests. Officers used physical shoving and batons a total of 577 times between the end of May and the end of June. The numbers reported are most likely far lower than actual incidents, as the audit relies on personal police testimony, often reported well past the 72-hour deadline mandated by the Department of Justice. The report itself states that if no clear number of incidents is given, specific use of force tallies for a given night will be one. Despite unprecedented police violence, protests have continued since June on a near-nightly basis, with the Bureau and the city facing multiple lawsuits over the weapons and violence used in crowd control. Total arrests since June have tripled, while PPB coordinated with county, state, and federal law enforcement to quell protests. Police say they are behind on reporting use of force due to a lack of funding and staffing, with only one sergeant available at times to review nightly reports containing over 100 acts of police violence. Responding to the presentation of Wednesday's audit, Portland Cop Watch said that not only is Portland out of compliance with the 2014 settlement, but, quote, it would seem that on its face, the PPB is also out of control in using weapons on Portland community members. A 2019 study revealed Black women were more than 30% likely to receive a formal grooming policy in the workplace. The Crown Act aims to end racially biased hair discrimination. Mary Sherman has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Many African Americans have experienced discrimination at school or on the job based on their natural hairstyles, but one bill is trying to change that. Kent State University junior Tewa Hines says that when she was in Catholic elementary school, she often was the target of discrimination because of her hair.
I around eighth grade, I had an afro, and the principal walked up to me and was like, oh, you're having a bad hair day? I am too. And I wasn't having a bad hair day. I just had my afro out.
The Crown Act was passed by the U.S. House in September. It provides legal protection for hair discrimination based on hair texture and protective styles such as braids, locks, twists, and knots in the workplace and public schools. Portage County's NAACP President Geraldine Nelson says the bill is long overdue.
Characteristics that are associated with dark skin, curly hair, those societally historically have been characterized in a negative.
There have been many reports in recent years of black students, both male and female, being banned from graduation or attending school based on their hairstyle. The Crown Act has not yet been approved by the U.S. Senate. Seven states have passed Crown Act legislation. Similar efforts in 17 states were not successful. In Ohio, State Representative Juanita Brent of Cleveland introduced the legislation this spring and says she understands the national need for the Crown Act, too.
It's important that people see themselves in government. It's important that people know that discrimination is not okay. And we are still not to the place where people are being accepted for what they bring to the table instead of just what they look like when they come to the table.
A 2019 study by personal care company Dove found that black women were more than 30% likely to receive a formal grooming policy in the workplace. For Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. This story was produced with original reporting from Ashley Johnson at Kent State.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on why President-elect Joe Biden should not pander to Senator Mitch McConnell, followed by an interview with Alex Karakatsanis, the head of Civil Rights Corps, about practical considerations of police abolition. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 55. Today in history, in 1907, under President Theodore Roosevelt, Indian Territory and Oklahoma Territory collectively joined the United States as Oklahoma, the 46th state. The quote of the day is from American writer and civil rights activist Maya Angelou, who said, quote, "Prejudice is a burden that confuses the past, threatens the future, and renders the present inaccessible." Allegations of widespread voter fraud may lack evidence, but they're drawing out the post-election process. Even so, as KBOO's Isabel Charlet reports, U.S. history is full of contentious elections that share similarities.
There is no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the U.S. election, despite President Trump's claims. But fraud allegations from Trump and some members of the Republican Party are affecting the nation's perception of the voting process. A Politico poll found that 70% of Republicans don't believe the 2020 election was free and fair. However, Allison Gash, a political science professor at the University of Oregon, says this isn't necessarily cause for alarm.
We've always had roughly half the country not supportive of a president who wins, either the incumbent president or a new president, and the country's been able to move forward and deal with it, even if the base of that particular opposition party is not happy with it.
Gash believes the media plays a key role in changing the perception of this election. She thinks news organizations should shift the story more toward President-elect Joe Biden rather than continuing to focus on allegations of voter fraud. Gash notes many elections have been heavily disputed and bitter, noting the U.S. Supreme Court was involved in the 2000 presidential race. And she says back then, most Americans didn't see it as the death knell to democracy. Gash predicts it will take time for some Trump supporters, including 4 in 10 Oregonians, to accept Biden.
I do think that there's going to be an approach that has been used by presidents from time immemorial to just move on with the business of the country and to hope that even though the outcome wasn't the outcome that they wanted, nevertheless, we need to sort of serve the public interest and move forward.
While President Trump has broken norms, like refusing to concede, Gash says the focus on the post-election turmoil is taking away from critical coverage of other pressing issues, like the surge in COVID-19 cases across the country. For the KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
In early November on the Ezra Klein Show, Stacey Abrams highlighted Oregon and Washington as good examples of states that want people to vote. She was speaking about suffrage or the right to vote and pointed to the two states as examples where voting is encouraged and voter suppression is nominal. In a tweet acknowledging the nod from Abrams, Oregon Governor Kate Brown said, quote, "Why Oregon? Automatic voter registration, vote by mail, and 82% voter turnout. If every state followed our example, we would be so much closer to ensuring that every eligible voter in the nation could make their voice heard," end quote. In the recent November election, record numbers of people across the U.S. voted early and by mail due to the pandemic, with top government and industry professionals touting the recent election as the most secure in American history. Many states across the U.S. will likely consider using mail-in voting systems like those in Oregon and Washington in the future. Stacey Abrams is a politician and lawyer from Georgia who is most recently known for her work as a voting rights activist with her organization, Fair Fight. In her interview with Ezra Klein, Abrams spoke to voters' rights and voter suppression in three categories. Abrams said, quote, "The architecture of voter suppression is, can you register and stay on the rolls? Can you cast a ballot? And does your ballot get counted?" To address these, she continued, quote, "Same-day registration, automatic registration takes care of the first. Early voting centers and making sure people have time off and all of those pieces take care of the second. And the third is making certain that because we now have uniformity in the ways we vote, we then diminish the likelihood of votes being cast out," end quote. Starting in 2016, Oregon was the first state to make voter registration fully automatic when issuing driver's licenses and ID cards. Since then, 15 other states and the District of Columbia have followed suit. Stacey Abrams, in her interview, spoke about the importance of automatic voter registration by saying, quote, "Your birth as a citizen is your guarantee of suffrage in the United States. That should be it. It should be the government's responsibility to register you to vote automatically, and it should be your option to take your name off the list, but it should not be an option of a bureaucrat to decide that you are not a voter," end quote. When it comes to casting a ballot in Oregon, the state consistently ranks as a national leader in voter turnout. All registered voters received an official ballot 2 to 3 weeks before an election to provide ample time to research issues and candidates and to either mail the ballot or drop it off at any official drop box. Countering President Trump's ongoing claims of voter fraud, a broad coalition of state and federal election officials released a joint statement last week calling this year's election, quote, "the most secure in American history." Co-signers to the statement include members of two election committees. The statement refutes Trump's attempt to discredit election results, saying, quote, "There is no evidence that any voting system deleted or lost votes, changed votes, or was in any way compromised." It also assures that all states within margins this election have physical paper ballots, meaning they can be recounted for added accountability. The statement was written and released by the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, a federal agency created by the Trump administration in 2018 to protect national cybersecurity. It falls under the Department of Homeland Security's oversight. Director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, Chris Krebs, reportedly told Associates he expects to be fired by the end of the week as the White House retaliates against attempts to debunk unfounded claims of fraud. Earlier this week, Assistant Director for Cybersecurity Brian Ware announced he was stepping down from the agency. Reuters confirmed Ware's resignation was requested by the White House. Trump took to Twitter to disparage election results, saying that it was, quote, "a rigged election." The president's tweet comes with a Twitter warning about misinformation. Trump still refuses to concede the election, saying Biden won because of voter fraud without evidence. And voters in cities and counties across the country passed roughly 20 police reform ballot measures. With more on those stories, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Trump says, "Make America great again." And that's a vision of an America that is not multicultural, is not protecting of people that are diverse in religion and gender identity and so forth.
Kenneth Stern with the Bard College Center for the Study of Hate says there's overlap between President Donald Trump's rhetoric and the ideologies of many far-right white supremacist groups. Thousands of people converged on Washington, D.C. this weekend for what organizers hoped would be a Million MAGA march, protesting the results of the election. Some Republican members of Congress attended, as well as members of far-right groups like the Proud Boys and the Three Percenters. Trump tweeted his first semi-recognition of Biden's victory yesterday, but continued falsely claiming fraud. In his first public remarks since the election, on Friday he conceded only to the idea he may not be in the White House next year.
This administration will not be going to a lockdown. Hopefully whatever happens in the future, who knows which administration it will be. I guess time will tell.
His remarks focused largely on taking undue credit for the Pfizer vaccine that recently announced a promising trial. Pfizer said it did not receive any funding from the administration, and it's not likely to be available to the majority of the American public in the timeframe Trump touted. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo called the Trump administration's current distribution plan, quote, an affront.
If the Trump administration does not change this plan and does not provide an equitable vaccine process, we will enforce our legal rights.
Georgia has until Wednesday to finish their manual recount of paper ballots. The results must be certified this Friday and then prepare for the January Senate runoffs. President-elect Joe Biden may campaign in Georgia for the Senate candidates in the coming months, according to Biden's team. Lorella Praley with Community Change Action says voter engagement efforts, especially in the state's Black and Brown communities, are crucial.
I am optimistic because there are groups like New Georgia Project on the ground working to fight for every vote.
Almost 6 months since the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, cities and counties have roughly 20 local police reform ballot measures to implement. Philadelphia, Columbus, and a few other cities established civilian oversight boards. Professor David Hooker at the University of Notre Dame says police violence is a systemic issue and will require a lot more.
People's Budget LA, that group that's been working for more than a decade, maybe 15 years, has been changing the narrative over time to say we want to spend our money on things that meet universal human needs as opposed to incarceration, marginalization, and punishment.
People's Budget LA was one of many groups that got ballot measure J passed in Los Angeles. It will allocate funding for community investment and alternatives to incarceration. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service and produced for television by Free Speech TV, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
An Acoma Pueblo leader says vital services were cut amid the COVID-19 pandemic, and a Little Shell tribal chairman wins re-election. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Indian Health Service has shut down the emergency room and inpatient services at a hospital located on Acoma Pueblo lands, according to Pueblo leaders. This comes as the tribe is seeing a spike in positive COVID-19 cases and as New Mexico sees record increases of cases. The hospital is located off Interstate 40, about an hour west of Albuquerque. According to tribal officials, the hospital will no longer treat patients with serious health conditions requiring hospitalization. Residents will have to travel to Albuquerque for critical care. Acoma Governor Brian Vio says the closure is reckless and immoral and points to federal responsibilities to the people of Acoma, especially during the pandemic, and says residents are expressing fear, concern, and anxiety. According to the tribe, hospital visits number about 90,000 a year. The leader of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe pleaded not guilty Friday to bribery charges related to plans to build a tribal casino, the Cape Cod Times reports. Cedric Cromwell was also removed as chairman by the tribal council following his arrest last week. Cromwell and the owner of an architecture firm were indicted on counts of accepting or paying bribes of a tribal government and conspiring to commit bribes, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Massachusetts. Cromwell was also charged with extortion. The allegations against him include using his position to enrich himself with bribes of more than $50,000, receiving home gym equipment, and staying in a hotel suite in Boston in exchange to contract and pay the architecture firm. The tribe has been working for years to try and build a casino in Taunton. The charges carry fines and prison time. The Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians in Montana saw its highest voter turnout yet for tribal elections. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas spoke with Gerald Gray, who was reelected, about his goals as chairman.
On November 8th, members of the Montana Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians re-elected all incumbent council members and executive board officials, including Chairman Gerald Gray, to his third four-year term appointment. Gray says securing federal recognition was his biggest focus during his last term as chairman.
We've only been recognized for about 10 and a half months, so I'm excited to continue this work on behalf of the membership and look forward to really making the tribe as successful as we can make it, at least in the next 4 years.
The tribe was federally recognized December 20th last year, opening access to many resources, including from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Indian Health Service, and the ability to purchase tribal land. To provide tribal members with health services, Chairman Gray says the tribe bought a small clinic in Great Falls in July.
We have to renovate to meet the guidelines of IHF because Indian Health Service will operate our clinic for us, I think, at a minimum of 3 years. And then we can slowly start to operate it ourselves after that.
Gray says it's important the tribe eventually offers its own health care independent of IHS, as he wants a holistic health care system for the tribe, modeled after a system used by Native tribes in Alaska rather than IHS, which Gray says is chronically underfunded and offers limited services. Despite rumors the tribe would purchase 200 acres for a reservation, Gray says it's unlikely they'd find a single tract encompassing the tribe's defined service area of Glacier, Cascade, Hill, and Blaine counties.
Don't get me wrong, under our economic development, we will buy land and we will put up elder veterans housing on those pieces of land that we do purchase.
The chairman says the tribe is planning to buy some land in the next month and a half in Cascade County. Chairman Gray says his overall priority is to find new ways to strengthen the Little Shell Tribe's economy. I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Energy-efficient homes stay more comfortable during power outages. Even during a winter blackout, you can expect a high-efficiency home to stay warm for several days. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Living in an energy-efficient home does not just save money on utility bills. A well-insulated, weather-tight house holds heat longer than one that's poorly insulated and drafty. Ryan Kolker is Executive Director of the Alliance for National and Community Resilience. He says during a winter storm,
if you lose power, the energy efficiency investments that you've made can actually keep you in your home.
A 2014 study from the Urban Green Council found that during a winter blackout in New York City, the temperature inside a typical single-family house would drop to 35 degrees Fahrenheit after just 3 days, but a high-efficiency house would stay above 60 degrees. An efficient house can also stay cooler during a heat wave, even without air conditioning, so it can reduce the risk of heat-related illness. And Kolker says if people can remain safely in their homes, that reduces the burden on a community's limited resources for emergencies.
And if you can stay in your house, you don't need to go to a shelter, which then reduces the impact on the community.
So he says as damaging storms, heat waves, and other extreme weather events grow more common, prioritizing energy efficiency can help communities keep their people safe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 16th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Hendrik Brokelshin, Isabel Charlet, and Samantha Law. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Diane Bernard, Lily Bolke, Roz Brown, Antonio Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, and Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage and Studio. Host Dime Roberts features the music of Portland musician Parfait Basal, Bhutanese poet Dilip Sunar, and the singers of the Tongan Sewing Circle. Then at 11, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews local artist Thomas Orr about his show Transitory Refuge and other questions. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined on the line now by Max Moran. He is an author and analyst and recently wrote the piece We Don't Have to Live in Mitch McConnell's World on the American Prospect. Thank you for joining us today on KBOO, Max Moran.
Thanks for having me.
And you have written about President Biden or President-elect Biden's cabinet and how it seems like they are raising the white flag of surrender already and going for corporate, centrist, or even rightist cabinet picks. Can you talk about why that's not the way that Joe Biden should be going?
Absolutely. There's plenty of reasons in terms of just the policies that the country needs right now why you shouldn't pivot to the center or pivot to the right in terms of the pandemic, climate change, and so much else. But it's also just factually unnecessary and unneeded. A lot of the arguments that you're hearing from lobbyists and from corporate America and Wall Street and so on for why Biden now has no choice but to pivot to the center is that if Mitch McConnell retains control of the Senate, he will control the votes needed to confirm any Biden cabinet appointees. This argument forgets that Biden doesn't actually need to go through the Senate in order to build out a cabinet. You can use the Vacancies Act, which allows him to appoint acting officials, or he can use recess adjournments. And there's also a method within the Constitution for him to, essentially, if he's willing to play a bit of constitutional hardball, to force the Senate into an adjournment in order to make these recess appointments. If you're talking about trying to compromise with Mitch McConnell, trying to find some sort of a consensus, a middle ground between Mitch McConnell and you, and you have the letter D next to your name, then you are on a fool's errand. We should know this. We should have known this long before the Merrick Garland fiasco, but we should certainly know now. There's simply no reason for Biden to try to appease Mitch McConnell when he never will, and he should instead govern aggressively and govern in a way that will actually improve people's lives.
Well, and all of the pandering to Mitch McConnell may not even be necessary in that he may not be a Senate Majority Leader. Right now, there's a lot of political money being poured into Georgia for the two Senate runoff races. I wonder if I could get your thoughts on that possibility.
Certainly. Obviously, if the Senate ultimately does just barely squeak by into the Democratic camp, then that completely changes the calculus. It allows the Democrats to confirm any Senate or any cabinet member which they would like. I think that it's important for us to also, you know, hope for the best and plan for the worst. As I lay out in the piece, there's a very bold, a very progressive agenda which Biden can pursue exclusively through executive branch powers. If the Senate ultimately does end up going Democratic, again, just barely, when you'll have swing votes, folks like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, very centrist-leaning individuals, You should like be certainly celebrating that, but also be looking to still use those bold executive branch policies in order to make change on many different fronts at once. We are in a situation in this country where there is so much that needs to get done immediately in order to prevent the climate change from being as bad as possible, in order to handle the COVID-19 crisis, in order to address long simmering racial tensions. There's simply no way for us to be pinning all of our hopes on flipping two seats. We most certainly should pursue them as aggressively as possible. But we also need to be planning for the worst if that is to come to pass, and there is most certainly an alternative agenda without Senate control.
Well, and I wonder if you would agree with the argument that a lot of people are making now, that Biden just barely won the election and was not as popular as Democrats thought because he was seen as too centrist and not progressive enough, like a Bernie Sanders, whose supporters were very, very favorable towards him, as opposed to many reluctant Biden supporters. Do you think that he was just not progressive enough and should be pushing more to the left?
Yes, I would certainly say so. I think that, you know, Biden didn't really inspire just about anyone. This was an unusual election in that we were up against this demi-fascist president, Donald Trump, who had caused so much innumerable harm. And quite simply, people were really scared, and that makes a lot of sense. They wanted to go with what they felt was the safe choice. I think that if you lived through the last week of just barely waiting and waiting and waiting to see if any of these states are going to flip, after there had been so much excitement for a potential clean sweep on Tuesday evening, I think you can see sort of from what happened there that, for one thing, I would dispute that Biden was ever the safe pick. I think that Biden was not a figure who particularly inspired anyone. He's not a figure who really stood up or stood for anything besides simply not being Donald Trump. And in this case, because people were scared and they wanted what they felt was going to be a safe pick, that was enough. But in 2022 and 2024, Democrats need to have something which they can take back to voters in order to say, hey, look, I've done this thing to improve your life in the midst of staggering inequality, in the midst of so much. I have done something to tangibly improve your life. If Biden's entire agenda tries to run through Congress, and if Mitch McConnell controls the Senate, there's simply no way that it's going to be able to do that. And so all he'll have to say in 2022 and 2024 is, well, you know, I tried to, you know, make a few tweaks to Obamacare or something, but, well, darn it, Mitch McConnell behaved in exactly the way everyone already knew that he would. And so I guess still vote for the Democrat for some reason? No, that's a nonsense argument. The much stronger argument is to instead embrace the substantial powers that he has in front of him. The Secretary of Education, for instance, as soon as Biden has one or an acting one, he can forgive 95% of student loan debt just through existing executive branch powers. He can send his Department of Justice to prosecute corporations. He can decriminalize cannabis nationwide. These are all incredibly bold, incredibly powerful solutions to the problems in front of us. And Biden just has to have the will in order to do that. And if he does, for one thing, it will make the country a much better place. That's what's most important. For another, just in terms of the raw electoral logic of it, it gives Democrats something that they can take back to the public.
Yeah, and you yourself have gone through and identified 277 policies that Joe Biden could enact on day one in his presidency without asking permission of someone like Mitch McConnell. Could you just outline what are some of the major policies that Joe Biden could enact in his presidency?
Sure. So those 277 policies that you mentioned, those are policies that were in the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force document. There's obviously a great deal more policies therein, but these are ones that just through existing powers across the executive branch, Biden can do from day one, as soon as he gets the right people in place. Like I mentioned, you can forgive 95% of student loan debt in this country because most of student loan debt is owed to the federal government. So same as any debt holder, the federal government can just say, you know what, I declare this loan resolved. I don't care about getting paid back anymore. There you go. Overnight, you've eliminated almost all of the largest category of consumer debt in this country. Like I mentioned, you can prosecute corporate monopolies, antitrust law that is entirely within the executive branch's domain. You can break up big tech. You can break up big ag. You can decriminalize cannabis nationwide. You can raise the poverty line in order to have it actually measure up to how poverty is experienced in this country, which will allow millions more people to access crucial social safety net programs. There's an incredible number of incredibly progressive things that you can do to, again, actively show people and actively intervene in people's lives in a way that's going to make government actually work for them, make existing parts of the government actually work for them. And all that Biden has to do is appoint the right people, give the right directives, and it's done.
And what do you think are the obstacles that Biden is facing, or the reasons why he is maybe hesitating on going that direction?
Well, I think that there's a lot of different reasons. For one thing, Biden is in many ways a very classic sort of transactional type of politician. He has sort of instinctively thought wherever the center of the Democratic Party happens to be from moment to moment, from year to year, throughout his many years in politics. Now, it's pretty clear that the center of the Democratic Party has shifted substantially to the left in recent years, but Biden has to recognize that, and he has to be willing and able to actually follow through on that. For one thing, if he wants to maintain this very fractious coalition, which actually brought him into the White House. For another thing, you know, Biden's campaign was funded in large part by traditional big money sources, and a lot of those traditional big money sources don't want to accomplish any of these things. Certainly, Wall Street doesn't want you to appoint bold regulators to the financial regulatory apparatus. There is actually cause for hope on that front. Biden's recently announced teams that are going into each of the agencies to review them. Gary Gensler, who was a real warrior for progressives when he ran the CFTC, he is leading Biden's financial policy regulatory team. So if you were upset after the 2008 financial crisis, well, you actually have an ally in the person who is, for right now, leading Biden's team there. There are other parts of these teams reviewing the different parts of the executive branch where there's quite serious cause for concern. But what Biden needs to hear from the grassroots and most certainly from senators and congresspeople is that, look, if you want to accomplish anything, you need to use the powers right in front of you. He needs a very unified front of people who are pushing and demanding and very specifically calling for these actions in order for him to feel comfortable taking that type of action.
And in order to get these more progressive cabinet picks, if McConnell is the Senate Majority Leader, you put forward two possible options. One is the Vacancies Act and one is the Presidential Adjournment Clause. Can you say a little more about how those mechanisms work to be able to get these cabinet members in place?
Of course. So the Vacancies Act is a extremely uncontroversial, extremely straightforward bill. It's an old law which allows the president to essentially appoint either a longtime civil servant within a given cabinet department, so someone who's been a staffer at the Treasury Department or at the Labor Department for a long time, take that person and say, I now make you temporary Secretary of Treasury or Secretary of Labor or so forth. This is the same power that Trump has used all throughout his time in office to nominate all these acting heads of XYZ agency. Now, Trump, of course, had the votes to confirm his nominees whenever he wanted to. He just didn't want to have to go through the work of going through the Senate and even have the risk of someone asking him a hard question. Republicans, in other words, have been using the Vacancies Act and these powers for 4 years now, and they are in no position to complain when Biden does so. They're going to complain anyways because they're Republicans, but Biden just shouldn't bother listening to them. That's the Vacancies Act. And then the Presidential Adjournment Act, or Presidential Adjournment Clause, rather, excuse me, that's an element within the Constitution that allows the president to basically be the deciding vote if the House and the Senate can't decide whether or not they want to adjourn. In that situation, the president gets to say, okay, you guys are going to adjourn for however long I say that you're going to adjourn, and that's that. We all know that when Congress is in adjournment, the president can put forward acting or temporary secretaries, acting or temporary heads of whatever agency they want to using recess adjournments. George W. Bush did over 100 of these. Barack Obama did over 100 of these. It's a very uncontroversial way to fill out your executive branch while you are waiting for Congress to get back into session. So in other words, Biden has two separate paths, neither of which require Mitch McConnell's sign-off to fill out his government. It's just a matter of him being brave enough to do it.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Max Moran. He is an author, and the most recent article that he's put out, We Don't Have to Live in Mitch McConnell's World. You can find that on prospect.org, the American Prospect. Max, thank you for joining us on KBOO today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO Radio.
We are joined now by Alec Karakatsanis. He is the founder and executive director of Civil Rights Corps, the author of the book Usual Cruelty. Now, you recently wrote for Current Affairs an article, Why Crime Isn't the Question and Police Aren't the Answer. And I wonder if we can talk about this reframing. A lot of people think it's the role of police to address and reduce crime. Why is this the wrong way to think about police and crime?
I think it's really helpful to begin historically and to understand that the reason that police developed in this country the way that they did has to do with the history of slave patrols and has to do with the history of very wealthy people who control local governments and control local societies trying to use their power to preserve their own wealth. And so policing actually got its real start in crushing labor uprising and in trying to put down any perceived slave rebellion and to capture people who had tried to escape slavery. And it has never in its entire history in this country ever been about protecting people from what they call crime or what police call violent crime, which are concepts that the police really constructed over the last couple hundred years to justify their own existence. But this is really propaganda. And you have to look no further, in addition to that history, and to look at what they do right now. Right, they tell us that they're so necessary because they have to protect us all from the serious criminals and violent crime. But only 4% of all police time around the country is devoted to what police call violent crime. And only 5% of all police arrests have to do with what the FBI calls a serious violent crime. That means that 95 to 96% of all police activity is doing something else. And it's in that other stuff that you, when one sort of peels back the layers, one sees what the police are really about. And that is about controlling and surveilling and punishing and brutalizing people who don't have wealth, and particularly black people and other people of color in our society. And that has always been the true function of American policing.
And when people think about police abolition, I know there's a lot of fear around that and a lot of anxiety on the idea that if police are abolished, then there will be nothing. So can you talk about what to fill in the gap, like what's needed in order to replace police if we were to abolish them?
When we talk about defunding police, it's portrayed as something radical and outrageous, and it's going to lead to anarchy. But what you have to understand is we could defund police departments by 80% of what we're paying them now, and we could go back to the way that it was in 1980. And that wasn't a society of anarchy or a society of radical outlaws. We would look very much like virtually every other country in the modern Western world if we defunded our police departments by 80 or 90%. So just to start with, when we talk about defunding police and then eventually rendering them obsolete and abolishing them and replacing them with things that actually help communities flourish, it's actually not that radical of a concept. In fact, Many communities around the country, wealthy communities, have very little policing and very little contact with the police. And what we're talking about is creating a society that is radically meeting people's needs. It is providing people with housing, with medical care, mental health treatment, and drug addiction treatment, and connections between human beings, so that we don't create as much trauma and violence as our current system is actually creating. And it's that sort of society where we're actually giving people the things that they need. If you look at more wealthy neighborhoods where so-called violent crime, the police say, is at very low, almost non-existent levels, those are places that have after-school theater and music and poetry programs and athletic programs. And those are places where people have safe places to live, and good jobs, and they can provide for their families, right? So these are the kinds of things that abolitionists are thinking about as alternatives to the existing carceral police state that we're living in. And I think it's very important to understand how not radical that is. It's about a different conception of public safety. It's about a conception of public safety that also includes Black and brown people and poor people, and not just the wealthiest people in our society who can afford to extract wealth from those other communities and then use a police force to protect it.
And during the protests that have gone on this summer, there's been a number of responses to the call for abolition, one of them being, how about we reform police departments? And Camden, New Jersey is given as an example. And you talk about that in your article. Why is that problematic and not the answer?
Almost all of the people that are talking about so-called police reform are actually trying to get more resources and more money and more cops into police departments. Now, Camden is a perfect example. They disbanded their police department, but then hired way more cops and then started making way more arrests of disproportionately Black people. That's the story of police reform in this country for decades, has been the story of the bureaucracy getting bigger. And it's not just the police force is getting bigger. You have to understand what that means. It's the power of police unions and jail guard unions and prison guard unions. And then it's the power of all of the people that work in the system, the judges, the prosecutors, the sheriffs, the probation officers, the parole officers. And then it's the power of the whole array of multi-billion dollar corporations that profit off of every single aspect of the system. The people that make the GPS monitors and the handcuffs and the sirens and the bulletproof vests and the military equipment that police use. The people that make all of the profit off of the jails and prisons that we have, the food service, the medical care. They're now multi-billion dollar companies that have contracted with local police departments and sheriff's departments to stop people from even having in-person contact visits with their family on the premise that they can make more money off prison and jail phone calls and video calls if they stop people from actually being able to hug and see their children. They'll pay more money for calls. This is the entire metastasized bureaucracy of American policing, which is far exceeding anything that we've ever seen in our own recorded history, and far exceeding anything that we've seen in the recorded history of the modern world. You have to understand, this is a country that is caging Black people at six times the rate of South Africa at the height of apartheid. And so people that are talking about making minor little reforms to that system are completely and utterly misunderstanding the scope of the problem.
Well, I think what we saw in the presidential election, where Joe Biden made a kind of not the strong showing that they were hoping, the Democrats were hoping, while the squad, the more leftists in the Democratic Party, did make progress, kind of shows that the American people are ready for more radical change. Do you think that is an accurate depiction of the kind of political scope that we're facing right now and where people are at?
I think people just want to live safe lives with their families and communities, and they want to have all of the things that are required for that, a place to live, adequate medical care, good places for their children to go to schools. These are all the things that police destroy, because when we're investing in policing, particularly in poor communities, communities of color, we're not investing in all of the other things that make communities flourish. And this, by the way, is a huge propaganda point, right? So if you take a look at the war on drugs, for example, we've spent trillions of dollars on the war on drugs. We've invaded other countries. We've firebombed Latin American rainforests. We've surveilled the communications of hundreds of millions of people every single day. We have caged tens of millions of people for marijuana possession alone, and even more people for all other drug use combined. We have separated tens of millions of children from their families, and we've placed millions of human beings into cages where they're likely to be sexually assaulted and physically abused and to contract infectious disease, right? All of these horrific things that happen in our cages, which are really torture chambers. And we've done all of this without the slightest shred of evidence that it does anyone any good. And I think ordinary people can see past that. They understand that devoting all of these resources to punishing people for drug use hasn't even reduced the use of drugs in this country. So people aren't stupid. People understand that we actually need to do the things in our communities that create the kinds of vibrant, safe, flourishing environments for children to grow up and for people to live and to exist together in community. And I think people, you know, have been subjected to a tremendous amount of police propaganda to try to convince them that police are somehow necessary for this. And not only that, the police in this current form, 5 times greater than the policing forces that existed just 30 or 40 years ago in this country. So I think that helps explain, you know, why whenever you actually sit down and talk to communities about what they want, they never say that they want more punishment and money spent on cages and handcuffs and tasers. They say that they want, like, to live good lives with their families, and they want safe places to be. And that's, I think, the message that is shining through when I talk to people all over this country.
Well, and I really want to thank you so much for that message. Again, we have been speaking with Alec Karakatsanis. He is the founder, executive director of Civil Rights Corps, and recently wrote the article for Current Affairs, Why Crime Isn't the Question and Police Aren't the Answer. Alec, thank you for joining us on KBOO today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Meow, meow. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
KBOO is excited to be part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year.